You know, every time I think we as pastors study God's Word, it's a challenge, and there's a battle, I think, that goes on a lot of times, as we just want to be faithful to what God would have to say to us through His Word. But every once in a while, it seems like there's an abnormal amount of spiritual warfare that takes place, and we believe God is sovereign and in control of all things, but there's also that mystery that we are battling against forces of darkness. And this particular week, the last couple of weeks, really, it's been really challenging, and I don't know what it is. I had taken a road where I thought this message would go, and spent an extensive amount of time studying to go down that road, and then completely changed it. And my hope is that God has something important to say to us, and of course He always does. Every portion of His Word is true and good and has something to speak to us. But I'm hoping that because this has been such a challenge, and because I've even been somewhat lost in this, not because it's a hard passage, but it's just been an abnormal struggle, I'm hoping that God will come through and speak something powerful to us this morning through His Word. And so I'm just going to pray again and trust God to speak to us. Lord, I thank You that You are faithful, that You're faithful to Your Word, Lord, and that in spite of the messenger, Lord, You work powerfully and mightily through Your Word. And I pray You would do that this morning. I pray You'd fill me with the Spirit, and I pray You'd open our hearts and minds to hear from You. I pray we'd be encouraged and empowered and renewed and refreshed and strengthened. And if there's anyone here who has not come to know You, I pray they would know You this morning and live. And I pray these things in Your powerful name, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. So in 1999, there was a civil war in Sierra Leone, Africa. There was a battle to gain control of the diamond fields there. Some of you may have seen the movie Blood Diamond that has this as its historical background. That story, of course, isn't true, but the events surrounding it were. And basically, this movie follows this character, Solomon Vandi, an African fisherman, and his son. And what happens is there's these rebel militias, the RFU. They come in and they take children to make them child soldiers, and they take people to make them slaves in the diamond fields. And Solomon, the main character, gets taken, and he's working out in these fields. He ends up finding a really large, precious diamond. Things happen, and he ends up being able to bury this diamond and escape this camp. And later on in the story, we find out that his son gets taken, and he's being trained and brainwashed to become a child soldier. And throughout the movie, you see Solomon, after he escapes, he's trying to get back and find his family. His wife ends up in a refugee camp that he's not allowed to go into, and she's not allowed to come out because they think that there might be rebels in this refugee population. And so he gets the news from his wife that his son was taken, and he goes on a mission. And basically, there's another character named Danny. Leonardo DiCaprio plays him. And this guy just wants to kind of use Solomon to get this diamond. But he's helping Solomon because he has this agenda to take the diamond. And so you follow the course of the story. But what you see is one man is going after the diamond. And while this character, Solomon, is wanting to get this diamond, he is really going after his son. His whole agenda, you see, is going after his son. You see him constantly caring about that. He's making statements like, these people are crazy for diamonds, but what he's after is his son. And he's continuously on this rescue operation to try to get his son back from these militia people. And basically, a bunch of events happen throughout the movie, and he gets to one of these camps, and he wants to go down to look for his son. And the other character with him, Danny, says, you're not going to ever find your son. All this guy Danny wants to do is get the diamond. He says, don't bother looking. But he doesn't care. He risks his life. He even does stupid things that almost get them killed because he wants to find his son. And one evening, he sneaks out while Danny's asleep, and they're supposed to be waiting. But he sneaks out to go look for his son, and he walks into the camp in the dark and in the rain. And he walks up to a child sitting at the table with these other kids, and he sees and recognizes his son. And he pulls on his son's shirt. He says, Dia. And he's trying to get his attention, and Dia turns around and looks at him and sees his father and shrugs him off. And then He's surprised by this, feeling like he's finally found his son and he's going to be able to rescue him. He tries to grab him, and Dia stands up in front of the other kids and says, "This man is a traitor. I don't know him. I hate you," he says to his father, and he repeatedly says, "I hate you. Get away from me. He's a traitor." And so the group ends up capturing his father. He does not end up being able to take his son out of there. And then basically through a turn of events of other groups trying to get a hold of this diamond, things happen. They end up out in the area where this diamond was buried. They're with some other people who are trying to take it, and some action scene kind of happens, and you're left with the three people, Danny, who wants the diamond, and Solomon and his son, Dia. And a conversation takes place, because right when they find the diamond, Solomon looks up and his son has picked up a gun. And his son is pointing the gun at Danny. And Solomon says, "Dia, what are you doing? Look at me. What are you doing?" He then says to his son, "You are Dia Vandi of the proud Mendi tribe." And at that point, or somewhere in there, his son takes the gun and points it at his father's face. And his father's speaking to him, reminding him, and speaking to him, saying, "You're a good boy who loves soccer and school. Your mother loves you so much." And he's reminding him of his sister and the farm and the food that his mother makes for him. And tears begin to stream down this father's face as he's speaking to this son. Tears coming down his face, the gun pointed at him by his son. And he continues to speak to his son, saying, "The cows are waiting for you. That wild dog that only listens to you is waiting for you." And he's trying to remind his son of his true identity, because his son has been brainwashed to where he's not even recognizing the love of his father. And this movie starts out showing the bond that they have when they would go fishing together and they would laugh and they would joke. But that's been severed and broken by these events that have happened. And at this point in the conversation, tears begin to stream down the face of Dia, Solomon's son. And Solomon continues to speak to his son, and he says, "I know they made you do bad things, but you're not a bad boy." He says, "I am your father who loves you, and you will come home with me and be my son again." And at this point, the son puts his gun down, and the father and the son are reunited, and the story goes on. But basically, what I think this scene illustrates for us is a picture of a forgotten identity, of a child who gets taken out by forces of darkness and forgets who he was and who his loving father was. So that even when he's standing in front of his father who loves him, instead he feels fear and he feels hostility rather than being able to be embraced by his father. He's forgotten who he was, and he needs this father to remind him that yes, they made you do bad things. Yes, they brainwashed you. Yes, this boy became a hardened killer. He had done horrific and unspeakable things, but the father's there to rescue him and bring him back to who he was meant to be and not to what he had become because he went down this road of darkness. This is the operation, the rescue operation of a father who loves his son. You know, I look in the news lately and I see that Ireland and in our own country and all over, people are, you know, the battle's being fought to redefine marriage. And I think in Ireland, that, you know, I don't know all of what that means, but laws were just passed and you see people holding up signs and cheering, and they're holding up equal signs with smiles on their faces. And it puts a picture in my mind where there's these people when they're holding these equal signs, what they're really saying is I have value. I have value just as much as you have value. I want you to value me. And the problem that I feel is, number one, these people do have value. They are equal. They have immense value, but they are redefining their identity by something lesser than the true identity that they were made for. They're redefining their identity based on merely a sexual orientation or whatever other thing that we exchange, where we exchange the truth of God for a lie and we settle for a lesser identity than the reality that we were made in the image of God, created to reflect His glory. And everything underneath that and below that is insufficient and a counterfeit identity that does not point to the immense value that we have as individuals. And so that's what I want to talk about this morning. Our passage is Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 28. and says, so God has been in the act of creating. He's been making things each according to their own kind. And here it says in verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So what we see right here in verse 26 immediately is God speaking. And what we've seen in all the verses that came before this in the creation account is that God just says, let there be this, let there be that. And it happens. He's creating by the power of his word. But here, it's like the story stops. And instead of him just speaking something into existence, we peek into a conversation that's taking place. And this conversation is God speaking within the context of his own self, the three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, in community together. Because it says, let us make man. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And so this is that idea that though we don't see the term Trinity here, this is all throughout the Bible, this concept that God is three distinct persons, one in essence. That God is Father, Son, and Spirit, that are together one God. We don't believe in multiple gods. But this is the something that often defies the limitations, at least. It pushes the limitations of our minds as far as being able to grasp and understand this. But here, God is having this conversation within himself. And it lets us peek in and see that God is communicating within himself. God, within himself, within this relationship that he has between the love of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, points us to this reality that God, who is love, is able to have eternal love within the relationships of the Trinity. Before creation ever happened, God was in community. This is an important thing to understand because we need to understand the reality of what the Bible teaches, that God is self-existent, that he's not in need of anything, that he's not creating out of need because he's complete. He has community, he has love within himself, and he is complete and self-sufficient and self-existent. And there's kind of a complex philosophical argument. Ravi Zacharias kind of puts it together and paraphrases it. It comes from Dallas Willard. I'm not sure if I can do it justice, but I'll just lightly point to two of its points. There's three parts of it. I'm just going to cover two. But basically it says that no physical entity can explain its own existence. It's kind of the idea that something doesn't come from nothing. We have a universe, basically, that cannot explain itself of how it got here. And then we also have a universe that has intelligence behind it. We see something like intelligent specificity. Things don't really aren't really chaotic. There's an intelligent design behind these things that we can't make sense of. And when you put these things together, you end up having to think, well, if we have something that is a physical entity that cannot explain its own existence, and something can't come from nothing, where did the something come from? And basically, as we step back, looking at something, trying to explain its existence, we have to keep stepping back. So if, for example, if we were to say, where do we come from? Well, we came from aliens. Well, where did those aliens come from? Well, those came from super aliens. Where did the super aliens come from? They came from crystals. Where did the crystals come from? And you just keep stepping back. And if you have to step back infinitely looking for something, you can never arrive at the present. That's kind of hard to understand, but basically, if you step back infinitely looking for a starting point, and there is no starting point, you can't arrive now. So it's logically impossible. What they say is that there must be at least one state that is self-existent, does not derive its existence from something else, and is a non-physical entity. And so I'm not going to get all into I'm not a physicist, and I don't want to make this overly complicated. But basically what I'm getting at is the idea that God himself is self-existent. Whether we can understand these arguments or not, it doesn't really matter, even if those don't make sense. The Bible teaches us that God is self-existent. And if we step back looking for an explanation to our own existence, the self-existent one, by definition, is the one who nothing, everything originates from him, everything is derivative and contingent upon him, but he has nothing that comes before him that needs to explain his existence. Because of his self-existence that the Bible proclaims, that he says about himself, he is the I am, he simply is, he by definition can be that non-physical reality that God is spirit, does not have a body like men, and fits this logically, that he can be the originator of everything. Ravi Zacharias gives this picture of if you pour out a can of alphabet soup, no one, you know, would look at those alphabets and think that just came there by chance. It's not you pour some flour in and some salt and bam, alphabet soup. And of course, I know that that would probably insult some scientists because I'm being, you know, reductionistic and I'm overly simplifying. But then again, if you were to pour that soup out and every time it came out, the letters came out in sequence. I mean, if you were watching a movie of somebody doing that, you'd be like, this is a horror movie or an alien movie or something. Because as soon as you see something like that, you know there's an intelligence behind that. Because those kinds of things don't just happen. They happen, if they happen that way, we immediately, our mind knows there's an intelligence there. And so it gives us creepy feelings if we were to see something like that. And so basically this just points us to that design aspect. And reminds us that God alone is self-existent. And because he's the self-existent one, he does not create out of need. He doesn't create out of need. Rather, he creates out of the overflow of his love. And that's a very different thing. I need my wife. I rely on her for so many things. I would die if something happened to her. But if I were to say, you know, yeah, I married my wife because I need her. I mean, you'd be like, that guy's not a real good husband. Right? And I do need her. But it's so different if I love my wife and I'm committed to her because I love her. You know, you hear stories of people where something happens to their spouse and they basically have to take care of that spouse like they're a child. They no longer are even the person that they once were, but the love is there and the commitment. They're no longer useful. It can't be need anymore, but it's love. And God did not create us out of a need within him for himself. God, who eternally loved himself outwardly within the relationship of the Trinity, has his love overflowing into creation. Basically, like in Islam, it talks about God being love, or Allah being love eternally. But Allah being one would only be able to love within himself, and his love becomes insular and reflected back in. It's a narcissistic, self-centered kind of love. But in the Trinity, we have an outward love in the persons of the Godhead loving one another. And when God creates, it is an overflow of the natural love that exists within his very nature. What we have in the Trinity is a unity that comes together in diversity. We have community. And as we speak about our being created in God's image, we see these things in how we naturally reflect God. We naturally have a desire for community and for relationship. If any of you have seen that movie Castaway where Tom Hanks is talking to the ball Wilson, you can see how desperately man needs relationship and community. We were not meant to be alone. We go crazy when we're alone because we were created in the image of a God who in himself lives within the context of absolute perfect community and unity in diversity. What we see a lot of times out in the world is people constantly trying to create a utopia or a heaven on earth apart from God. I see that in the new atheist movement that constantly wants to say that religion is the problem. It's not a new argument. We've heard that all throughout phases of history before, and it always ends up leading to the oppression of people, the silencing and robbing people of free speech, the putting of down of people in exchange of power. But there's always people who think that they can create a utopian society and bring heaven on earth if we just get rid of this thing or that thing. And so often it's an attack against God. It's a mistrust. It's a hostility. It's a forgetting of our true identity and what we were made for and exchanging the truth of God for a lie and settling for a lesser counterfeit identity. What we see in man is that there's an innate intrinsic longing basically to go back to Eden. There's a longing within us to go back to that place where we would be in the dwelling place of God. Where, like we're reading in this passage, before the fall comes and before sin and death enter the world, man was with God. In the next chapter it says that God would come walking in the cool of the garden. God was with man. We were in community with man. We had an unbroken relationship with him, and we were in paradise. I talked before about how Graham Goldsworthy defines the biblical concept of kingdom, that it's God's people and God's place under God's rule, and how this is a picture, at least symbolically, in Eden, of being under the righteous reign and absolute peace that we have when we are in God's kingdom. That Adam and Eve were obeying God, and they were listening to him and trusting him. And they were in his place, in peace. Death had not entered the world, and they were living out their existence as they were meant to. But we, with sin having entered the world, have come to this place where there's a natural longing to go back to that, but so much of the time people are trying to attempt to get there apart from God. And we can never get there. But God has come on a rescue operation. We do have a loving Father. Unlike our earthly fathers who fail us, God is the perfect loving Father. He is the Father within the Trinity, is a perfect example of what it means to be a father. And so though our earthly fathers fail us, God is the perfect Father. And he is on this rescue operation like this character Solomon. The reality is that Eden is not a full manifestation of the reality of what God has intended in his creation. It's not enough to want to go back to the Garden of Eden. We need to go beyond it. And it's God's intention to take us beyond it in the reality of the new heavens and the new earth, where righteousness will dwell, where there'll be no more tears and no more death. And we will go beyond what Eden even was, but perhaps what Eden was meant to be, as I hope I can explain as we move forward. If we go to the next verse, verse 27, it says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." What we see here is this idea of God creating humanity. The very first thing where it says God created man, it's just the Hebrew word Adam, or the Greek word anthropos, you know, anthropology. It's humankind is basically what it's saying. And so God creates humanity in his own image. Then it says, in the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And basically what we see is this idea that we were created to be images of God. We were created to reflect God. Kind of got lost in my notes here, but here's the thing. God created male and female, and he created them to represent him. I don't want to mislead anybody to think that you are in any way insufficient if you're single. This is more an idea of God's design. And because we are intended to reflect God, who lives in community within himself and brings unity together in diversity, it would make sense that for us to reflect God, it would take more than one person. That male and female collectively, diverse, being brought together into unity, reflect God's image. And so when we reflect God's image, we've reflected collectively. It doesn't mean that you as a single person don't reflect God's image, but God's intention in creating male and female and creating them to reflect his image is that we are reflecting God's perfect love and how he so wonderfully brings unity and diversity together. Men and women are so different, and yet when a marriage works, those differences actually work out for good. Of course, they can work out for bad and things can go south. A loving, wonderful marriage is a wonderful picture of how something so diverse and people so different who don't even seem to be speaking the same language can come together and work together so well. And so we are made basically to reflect God's image. This idea of image in the Greek, there's a word icon, or I think maybe the Latinized version is icon, but the idea is that we are icons. Images. I think icons is a fitting term for us today because we all use computers. And so we can think of this idea where there's this little icon. It's a little image on your computer. In this book, God Dwells Among Us, they paint this picture. So you click the icon and it opens up what? A program, a website. The icon is just a picture that points to the greater reality, the thing behind it. And it opens up this whole new thing that you can, whatever you're going to do, whatever you're going to do. An icon, though, that points to itself is a defective one. If it just click and it doesn't do anything, it might be a nice looking little icon, but it's not being used in the way that it was intended to be. That icon is meant to be a picture of the greater reality that lies behind it, of the thing that it was intended to reflect. And that's what it means to be created in God's image, is that we have a deep value that sets us apart from the rest of creation. And it doesn't mean that the rest of creation doesn't have value. There's something very unique and very precious about human life because we've been created in the image of God. I kind of skipped over this in the last verse, but basically when it says, let them have dominion, and then it speaks of the fish and the birds and the heavens and the livestock and basically everything alive on earth, it's speaking of that kingdom concept of the idea that Adam and Eve were intended to rule. And I don't usually use alliteration, but this is kind of a nice one where Adam and Eve were intended to reign as representatives that resemble and reflect God's image. And so God has designed us to be like Him in reigning, like Him in what He does. Basically, we are intended to spread God's glory to the ends of the earth. And I personally believe that this was God's intention even in the Garden of Eden, that in one sense, that paradise, that dwelling place of God that Eden was, where it was sort of a symbolic temple, a temple is a dwelling place of God, that was intended to spread out and fill the earth. And that is still what God is doing today, as He spreads His glory out by images of people who love Him and trust Him going out into the world and reflecting His glory and proclaiming the good news to the world. God is still expanding His glory to the ends of the earth. And when we get to the new heavens and the new earth, that glory will cover the earth. Like Habakkuk 2:14. You know, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And that's where we're headed. And that's what God was doing here, I believe. Even in the Garden of Eden, even before the fall, God was expanding His glory. God had created man in His image, out of His delight and out of His love. And He was going to let that cover the earth. And of course, this is not a self-centered thing like a human. You know, if I want to make myself great and make myself known, it's not a good thing because of the corrupt nature of my heart. But God, who created us and made us and knows what we need and created us to be in community with Him, reflect His glory and feel the love that He has for us, when He spreads out His glory and when He spreads out His name among the world, it's a whole different thing because it's good. It's perfect. It's true. It's what man needs. It creates a perfect place. So I defined glory a long time ago because we say that a lot, God's glory. I want to read this again from God's Heart for the Nations. It's a Bible study the women are doing. And this is a definition of glory that I think is really good that comes out of that study. And it says, glory is the splendor, majesty, honor, and reputation of God. Glory is used to describe the power of God. The Hebrew word most often translated glory in the Old Testament is kabod, to be heavy, weighty, honored. So it is the weightiness of the presence of the holy and majestic God when we're talking about glory. God's glory is the self-manifestation of God's character, attributes, and actions as He invades human reality. And so when we're talking about God's glory being spread to the ends of the earth through the images that He's created, we're talking about this reality of the weightiness of what God is, His attributes, His essence, His goodness, His character, overflowing and permeating the world. This won't be a bad thing, this will be a good thing. You know, I think a lot of times people might even have a belief in God, but they cling more to an idea that could be defined as deism, where, yes, I believe in God, but I also believe that really, that like He created the world, He created nature as a closed system, and now nature governs everything that's going on, but He's kind of hands off, He's not really involved, He's kind of just a spectator. That's not what we believe, for those of us who believe the Bible. That's not what we believe as theists. We believe in a God who is intrinsically involved in everything. That even if there are laws of natures and things, those are only secondary to God who is behind all of it. In Him we live and move and have our being, as Paul proclaimed in the book of Acts. So basically, what I want to be getting at continually this morning is this idea that if we don't get our identity from the reality that we were created in the image of God, we always will end up settling for counterfeit and lesser identities. We won't find a true purpose of what we were created for. We'll settle for other things, namely idols or things that we replace God with, and we'll find our identity in those things, and we'll define ourselves by those things, and we'll try to live our life as if those things can give us purpose and meaning and destiny. and they end up failing us. They end up leaving us empty. They end up deceiving us. We end up becoming brainwashed like this child. We end up becoming distrusting of the Father who loves us. We end up hostile to God so much of the time. We end up not being able to enter into that place of peace where we have a secure identity in the one who made us in his image that we were meant to have. And we need to hear the voice of the Father who's calling us back and trying to remind us of our identity. Yes, we're sinners. No, we're not perfect people. But God has made a way to lift us out of that in his rescue operation. God has made a way to say, I love you. I love you. And you're coming home with me. Stop believing the lies of these brainwashers and the forces of darkness that want to tell you there's something better over there or that you can't trust me. And believe me and come home. And I believe that the Father has spoken so clearly in his word and in creation this message of love, because this Father has made the way. Some of us might say, I don't know the way, but Jesus stands in the midst of us and says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through me. But it pleased the Father to send his Son and crush him to give us back our true identity as image bearers of God, so that we could be liberated from the lies of false and counterfeit identities that lead us down a meaningless and empty path to death, and we could be complete in the one who knows what we were made for. And we could find our life in him and our hope in him. We could be set free from all the things that are behind us, even yesterday, whatever the things are that are in our closet, whatever sins we have, we can forget those. Like Solomon telling his son, I know they made you do bad things, but he wants to bring him out of that and bring him to a place of freedom. But God the Father wants to do that for us, and that is why he sent his son in love on this rescue operation of sending his son to die for our sins so that we could have life, so that we could be made whole again, and so that we could truly reflect his image as he created us to. And then in verse 28, it said, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. G.K. Beale and Mitchell Kim say in this book, I really like this book, it's called God Dwells Among Us, and they say, just as God subdued the chaos, ruled over creation, and then filled the earth with all kinds of animate life, so Adam and Eve were to subdue, have dominion over all the earth, and then be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth with images of God. And so it's that idea right here, that the very thing that they were commissioned to do, sent out to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, is what God was doing. They were reflecting him even in his creation. As we'll see in the next chapter, Adam will name the animals, and it says, they say that Adam rules over creation by speaking and naming the animals, just as God ruled over creation by speaking and naming parts of creation. So we're constantly reflecting God. And the things that God calls us to do, we're reflecting him. Even marriage, why it's important is because it's God's design, the way he defined it. It's not about trying to limit the freedoms of other people. It's about trying to not cloud the picture of God's design, of the things that were intended to reflect him, because marriage was intended to reflect the relationship between God's love for his people. And when we cloud that design and we muddy it, we obscure that. I think that's so much of why it matters, is that we were created to reflect God's image correctly, in a true way that leads people to see what's true. And that's what God was doing here as he gave them this commission. God blesses them, it says. But then he tells them what he wants them to do. He wants them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion. So they're to rule over the earth. Just as God is the rule, the ultimate ruler, Adam and Eve were to rule. They were to have dominion and subdue. They were to rule on behalf of God. So in history we have something called suzerain kings and vassal kings, and all it means is there's big kings and little kings. There's kings of kings and smaller kings. And vassal kings a lot of times were allowed to rule within their own little internal area autonomously so they could make their own decisions, but ultimately they reported to the king of kings, the suzerain king. And that king, if he called them to war, they'd better show up, because at the end of the day they were under the rule of the king of kings. And a lot of times those were more of an oppressive relationship, probably, of conquered peoples. But with God, it's not the case. God is the King of Kings who calls us to lead and to rule and to reign and to represent and reflect Him in the way that we ultimately will reign with Him. Not this side of eternity. This side of eternity, we're to follow the one who laid His life down. We're to follow Him on that mission. But it's the same mission that Adam and Eve were given, to spread the glory of God to the corners of the earth. The only difference now is that it's this side of the fall, and we'll be getting there soon and talking about how sin and death have entered the world. But the Bible teaches that we are ambassadors, that we are ambassadors of a righteous king. And what does an ambassador do? He goes to the other nations. He goes to the other kingdoms. And he represents that king, and he'd better represent that king correctly. He'd better represent the wishes of that king and the character of that king. So the ambassador would constantly be sent, and he'd be making decisions and interacting with other kingdoms. And that's what God is calling us to be, ambassadors, representatives, and reflections of Him and His glory throughout the earth. That we could go confidently out into an earth, the earth where people are hostile to what we believe, where people think we're narrow-minded for what we believe, where people want to silence what we believe. But if we've truly found our hope and our true identity that is rock solid, having been created in the image of God and then having been redeemed by Him, we can be confident going out into the world as ambassadors. It's not something we deserve. It's something that by grace through faith He bestows upon us. It's an amazing thing that God uses such weak things of the world to do His purposes, like me up here preaching. It's amazing how God works and just shows how beautiful and wonderful He is and how creative and how free He is to do things as He would will. But basically in this passage, or not in this passage, but an upcoming passage, we realize that Adam, you know, he doesn't fulfill the calling that he has. He doesn't end up subduing the serpent. He doesn't have the dominion. He doesn't live out that dominion or that rule the way that he was supposed to. And so sin and death enters the world. But what we're shown in the Bible is that the Adam, the true Adam, Jesus the Christ that would come later, would not fail. But that he would conquer the serpent. And that he would crush him. That he would conquer death and sin. And the rescue operation would be complete. So that the Father could bring us back and bring us home. And the Father, I think, just like Solomon speaking to his son, reminding him of who he is, would like to speak to us. Remember your true identity, that you were created in my image, and don't settle for something less or for a counterfeit identity. Embrace what you were made for and have life. God the Father has gone on the operation, the rescue operation, to send his son into this world and to bring us home. Adam was sent out of the dwelling place of God. He was put outside of Eden, no longer allowed to take on that role. And he was put outside of that place where we had absolute unity with God, and he was separated from God. But because of Jesus Christ, the true Adam, the dwelling place of God will be with man again. And so we're in the first chapter of the Bible. If we go all the way to the last book of the Bible, the Revelation, we go to chapter 21. We kind of peek in at the end of the story. This is talking about the new heavens and the new earth, the direction that we're headed. And it says in chapter 21, verse 3, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." And so that's the reality because of the true Adam, because of the Father who loved sending his Son into the world to bridge the gap and bring us back in to be with him in the dwelling place, to restore Eden, but not merely to the limitations of what Eden was, but far beyond it, far beyond what our imaginations and minds can even perceive of what's coming for those who love God. And God will be with man, and we will be in his dwelling place. We will be under his righteous rule, where righteousness reigns forever. And all of those other things will be wiped out that we're struggling with. As we struggle through this life, often clinging to counterfeit identities and false gods and idols and things that we trust in besides God. Tr- trusting in our own minds, trusting in our own education, trusting in our jobs, trusting in our abilities, trusting in whatever. When we aren't trusting in God, we aren't living as we ought to. We're not living as complete people who understand what we were designed for. A true identity as image bearers of God. And so what we're going to do this morning in coming forward to take communion together, this is something we do as believers who trust in God, to remember what was done. In this rescue operation of the Father who sent His Son, the Son's blood was spilled out for us. And we take this cup to remember that. And His body was broken. And we take the bread to remember and worship Him and embrace who we are in Him with gratitude and worship and thanksgiving. And so that's what we're doing. And if you're not a believer, this isn't really for you. But I'd encourage you to be a believer right this moment, to put your trust in Him right this moment, and with your heart, believe and be justified, and with your mouth, confess and be saved, and come and take part in this with us as the people of God, as the people who have embraced our true identity in Him.